ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A confession. A memory. A lie. What if all three could be wrong? Forensic is a new series from All in the Mind, unpacking the hidden psychology of crime solving. Why innocent people confess? How memories can be rewritten? The science behind true crime. All in the Mind, Forensic. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
With the Russian and Chinese presidents meeting in Beijing, wouldn't you like to have been a fly on the wall for that one? What makes Putin tick? The president of Russia has wielded power for 26 years. He's an elusive figure, hard to make sense of. Let's try. Hello, I'm Natasha Mitchell. Welcome to Big Ideas.
He has got an actual freezing chamber where he goes to try to keep himself, to extend his life. I mean, he doesn't drink. He's obsessed with health.
He will die. And that's what we need to be thinking about. What comes after Putin?
Join me on stage today with two close watchers of Vladimir Putin. The Russian president has wrangled it so his leadership is locked in for at least another decade, until 2036, if he lasts that long. We've seen Putin quash his critics in brutal ways, even those close to him. We've seen him wage war on civil liberties, civil society, democratic institutions, foreign NGOs, the press, LGBTIQ plus people, drug addicted people, activists, academics, and of course, on Ukraine. And in the current global chaos, how will his allegiances with Iran, China, Cuba, North Korea play out? Who is Vladimir Putin really? What does he want? What are his influences? And how has he evolved across his decades in power? William Partlett is Associate Professor at Melbourne Law School, Fellow at the Centre for Public Integrity, and author of Why the Russian Constitution Matters, The Constitutional Dark Arts, and co-author of The Post-Soviet as Post-Colonial. Dr. Elizabeth Buchanan, a senior fellow at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute and founding co-director of Polar Warfare Studies at the Modern War Institute at the West Point Military Academy, is author of Red Arctic, Russian Strategy Under Putin, and So You Want to Own Greenland, Lessons from the Vikings to Trump. She formerly worked in defence. Let's dive in. Join us with an audience at the recent Sorrento Writers' Festival on the lands of the Bunurong people.
Let's give them a warm welcome. Look, before we get up close and personal with Putin, let's anchor ourselves in the present moment. How do you see Putin on the world stage right now in relation to Iran, China, South Korea, Cuba? He's just done a nuclear deal, I think, a power plant deal in Vietnam, so in our region. It's an interesting time. How do you read Putin as a player, Will?
So the first thing to say is since the invasion of Ukraine, it's very clear that Russia has been forced to turn to Asia. So, I mean, Russia's always, has long been an Asian power, but it is now very much an Asia-focused power. And that means relationships with Indonesia, Vietnam, and so on and so forth. And I think Liz can tell us more about that. And it is, and that has been, a significant pivot that is, it is actually reshaping the region in a really significant way. And I think, particularly in Australia, it is going to impact us and already is impacting us. It is very clear that the war in Iran is, in some cases, significantly helping the Russian regime. They are now getting billions of dollars of oil revenue that they weren't getting before. They are now, the Asian economies, particularly China, now increasing the reliance on Russia now for oil. That means they've got more leverage in that very important relationship between Russia and China. So, you know, it's fair to say that, you know, the war in Ukraine is not going particularly well for the Russians, but this war in Iran in the Middle East is helping them and giving them a fill-up in a quite difficult period domestically. So we're going to talk more about domestics in a second.
Elizabeth, how do you think Putin sees this moment in terms of, you know, I mean, he's doing fuel deals with China, with Cuba and other parts of the world. Is that about allegiances? Is it about consolidating his power, friendship, loyalty? What is it?
So this is the first point. I think Putin is completely, and Russia today is really, really misunderstood. So it's all of those things. They have a different view on alliances and the place and I guess the value of working with other countries. It's really easy from the outside in that we can argue, you know, you've got a China-Russia axis that's emerging, but in reality there's a lot of competitive and mistrust tenets to that relationship. But when it comes to the energy part, and it's something one of my first books looks at, energy is, you know, the heart of Putin's great power, if you will, strategy. It's the resource base that Russia sits on is huge, so it's always going to feature. On the Iran point, I think it's been interesting to see, you know, some people have argued, where is Russia? Why hasn't Putin come to the rescue of an ally? Well, frankly, that just highlights the completely different view of how Moscow treats its allies. Very different world.
Well, but he has offered strategic support to Iran through intelligence and satellite.
Hasn't been as forthcoming as well. Same could be said for much of South America. On the fuel point, we as a country have donated so much fiscally, diplomatically as well to Ukraine, but the fact remains we have given more in a fiscal sense to the Russian government through our fuel, our diesel purchases from India. Everything is refined there. It's Russian crude. So that's a key point to make. And another point on, I guess, the energy sort of relevance to Putin in our region in Asia is think of the money that we donate to, that DFAT puts out for Laos, for Bangladesh. You know, it's quite a lot of money of your taxpayer dollars. And I think it's really interesting to see the number of agreements that have been inked under Putin, especially in the last decade, with Laos and Bangladesh. These are, you know, developing countries that are going to have nuclear power stations built by the Russians, run by the Russians, maintained by the Russians, right on our doorsteps. So a lot of our focus can be on what China is doing in the region, how a vacuum has appeared, and we've got Chinese investment. But for me, I look at some of the energy infrastructure, and Russia is certainly relevant there.
And what about, Will, Trump's relationship with Putin? I mean, Trump is doing Putin's heavy lifting for him in relation to weakening NATO, it would seem.
Yeah, I mean, it's been described, this relationship has been described as almost like kind of teenagers in love and the parents don't really like it, right? So it's this idea that, you know, Trump and Putin really do want to get along, but there is a lot of strategic kind of issues that particularly in their huge bureaucracies in both the U.S. and Russia. Which
do they really want to get along, or is it a puppet master and the puppeteer?
I think they want to get along. I don't think that Putin has any information on Trump or anything like that. I think they actually just share a view that of how power operates. It should be personalized. It should be centralized, and decisions should be made by the great man, the strong man. They really love that kind of idea of power, and they want to project that. Our masters, we'll talk more about this, of communication, right? Communicating, projecting power, showing power, and so forth. So as a result, they love to be with each other, but the strategic interests of their two countries significantly differ. So we see this kind of tension in the relationship that goes on, but it's very clear that Trump wants Putin and wants his approval in some cases, and vice versa. And that is a really interesting dynamic in the ongoing Russia-US relationship. Mm.
It's also a sense of just personalities, right? It's got nothing to do with ideology anymore. These are grifter gangsters. They're smash and burning their countries. And the idea that there's any key roadblocks to Russia and the US, quote unquote, resetting, I think we're seeing in real time what's left of the liberal rules-based order, if it's in the room with us, it's disintegrating. So, yes, there are strategic interests that can overlap, and there's always going to be things that you diverge on. But I think right down to the core of who these men are, it is self-interest.
Let's then drill into his character, Putin's character, because this session is all about what makes Putin tick. Take us back to his childhood, Will, and then maybe take us into his KGB career. So he's born at an interesting time. His family has survived the Nazi invasion of Leningrad. Two previous children have died in tragic circumstances, one from starvation in infancy. So he is born after the war, some years after the war, but he's born into a crucible of poverty and no doubt grief and trauma. And I gather he was a bit of a roustabout kid.
Yeah, so he's born in Leningrad, which is now St. Petersburg, which was subject to an almost three-year siege by the Nazi Wehrmacht, and you know, thousands upon tens of thousands of people starved to death. He grows up in a Leningrad, where that is deeply remembered. As you say, it's a family story. It's part of who he remembers himself to be. The Soviet Union in the post-war period takes decades to recover economically, to regain its power and to pull, you know, the people out of poverty. So that's what he remembers as a child. And he grows up watching KGB TV shows on Soviet TV, and he wants to be in the KGB. He actually goes to a KGB officer when he's 16 years old and says, what should I do? What should I study to join the KGB? They tell him, go to law school, become a lawyer. And it's a fascinating insight into him and who he is, and we're going to talk more about it. This is a lot of what my interest is in Russia, is unpacking the constitutional and legal kind of aspects of Putinism, as it's now being called.
And what keeps him in power.
And how he uses structures and law and so forth to keep himself in power. So he goes to law school and joins the KGB and ends up in Dresden in the GDR, the East German state that's a client state of the Soviet Union, when the Soviet Union collapses. And he talks about this in his book. I remember reading it when I was first in Russia in 2000, where he talks about he's making phone calls to Moscow. What should I do? What should I do? No one's answering. Mm. And he, to this day, I think this is an important part of his life. He sees state collapse, the anarchy he sees that's unleashed when the Soviet Union collapses. He's terrified of this. And this very much forms his idea of what power is, how power should be exercised, and the role that he should play in what he sees as rejuvenating Russian power.
And he's out of the country in the build-up, in the big campaign by Gorbachev, Glasnost, Perestroika. So he doesn't see that kind of mobilisation or doesn't feel the buzz of it at all, and the sort of unleashing of unfettered capitalism.
Precisely,
But he arrives back as it's having its tragedy.
And he comes back to St. Petersburg and he works for the mayor. The mayor hires him, who's actually a Yeltsin, who's going to be the president very soon, a Yeltsin kind of accompaniment. And he works for the mayor and he actually works on just getting food into St. Petersburg. In the early 90s, St. Petersburg almost starves because of the full-scale collapse of the Soviet system and the inability to get food from the countryside into the city. So he's, again, it's the same story that we see from him of survival is a really significant part of his mindset.
He ultimately becomes the head of the SFB, which replaces the KGB. And then not long after that, he becomes president after he replaces Yeltsin. And it's interesting, I think it's illustrative at this point to remind us that people talk about the many faces of Putin, that he's hard to pin down. And there's an interesting quote by Richard Sakwa, a political scientist, where he says he's a protean figure onto which people project their own prejudices, ambitions, aspirations and hopes. And I wonder to what extent you think that's true. And then we'll hurtle into his presidency.
Well, so I think certainly when he comes to his, into the late 1990s, when he becomes kind of the heir apparent to Yeltsin, he is an unknown figure. People don't know who he is, really. He has no public profile. He's a pretty bad public speaker at that stage, and he has none of this charismatic authority that he later on manufactures through the state media that we now see, shirts off and so forth, right? He is, at this stage, an unknown figure, and as a result, he's able to be a bit of a shapeshifter. So he takes the presidency in 2000, and he systematically eliminates the oligarchs as a political power, and that's significant. The 1990s, Yeltsin is particularly towards the end, a very, very sick man and a presidency that's kind of empty. And it's and Russia's being run by oligarchs like Boris Berezovsky and others, Mikhail Khodorkovsky and others. And when Putin comes in, he says, look, I'm going to reassert the power of the state. And he then systematically instrumentalizes the law and systematically prosecutes individuals, including Khodorkovsky, and puts him in prison, you know, bending the rules, changing the rules in all kinds of different ways.
He's pro-free market. But he's reigning in the oligarchs.
Yeah, I mean, he is very much reigning in these oligarchs and abusing the law in the process, centralizing vast amounts of authority in the office of the president in his own hands, on one hand. So he's doing this. So he's really asserting a kind of centralized, personalized, authoritarian rule at home. But internationally, he's the first individual to call George W. Bush after 9/11. He wants to join NATO. He wants to create alliances at least at this stage with the West. Now that changes very quickly after the Iraq War in 2004, but we do see an early Putin who is saying, look, I want to get personal control over the Russian state and centralize authority, but it also is thinking geopolitically about potentially an alliance with the West and creating a personal relationship with George W. Bush. You may remember George W. Bush looks into his eyes and into his soul.
I saw his soul.
So this is a time of unprecedented...
The West was courting Russia.
Yeah,
Russia was courting the West.
And terrorism was the ultimate thing, because in both cases, I think George W. and Vladimir Putin, you know, they saw terrorism as a threat to the state, and that is something that Putin very much believes in, is the state.
And this is something, this period that you're talking about, that we overlook completely in an international relations, foreign affairs discourse. For now, I think at least for the last, 10, 11 years, it's been a case of Cold War warriors resurgent and the idea that anything that Moscow has its fingers in is a problem, that's our arch enemy, you know. A generational jump back into history. But what are the lessons and, you know, what was the promise and the potential of what could happen in those formative years?
We're asking, what makes Putin tick? Natasha Mitchell with Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen. From the Sorrento Writers' Festival with seasoned Russia watchers and scholars, Associate Professor Will Partlett and Dr. Elizabeth Buchanan. Coming up, he is no fan of Soviet-era communism. So what philosophy drives Vladimir Putin? And what about religion?
Yeah, how do you see that initial courting of the West? I mean, Exxon, all the big oil companies were entering Russia doing big deals on Putin's terms. Very interesting.
They were a lot of the period. So in a former life, I worked for my sins, a Royal Dutch Shell, so an oil company. And they were very interested in the offshore Arctic. And just by sheer geography, when it comes to the Arctic area, over 50% of it's Russian. Legitimately, nothing here ideological, just the application of international law and the end of your continental shelf extends under the seabed, it's Russian. So you had an influx of Western firms, European, mainly the US ones, look and oil companies don't think about 10 years, they don't think about 20. They think 50 to 60 years. They think in terms of those future markets. So they were in. Rex Tillerson, if anyone remembers, a former Secretary of State under Trump won. He was the person that was inking the deals on behalf of ExxonMobil to get into the Russian Arctic. So when private sector, especially oil companies and financial markets start pivoting to Russia, that's a huge flag. If they see something on the horizon that's worth getting in on early, politics be gone.
So that obviously served Putin's interest in rebuilding the Russian economy. But was there an alignment of values with the West at that time, do you think, or was that just a mirage?
No, it's just transactional. It's just statecraft 101. It nested nicely into what Putin needed to do to unlock the future resource base for Russia. The Russian economy will depend now on what happens in the Arctic. Segue into my favourite topic, polar geopolitics, thank you. But we have all sorts of countries, China we know well, India, United Arab Emirates, they're all investing in the Russian Arctic. Earlier this year, late January, you had the South Korean government legislate, keeping in mind this is an active sanctions party against Russia, legislate that they need to have access in the coming decades to the Northern Sea Route. So you've got key Asian shipping markets that are looking to utilise the Russian Arctic coast to get trade moving in the future between Asia and Europe. That does huge things for Australia. It makes our market extremely expensive to service. We're at the end of the earth and we need to be, point of caution, we need to be looking at the new strategic waterways that are opening up globally.
Yeah.
And we're at the outskirts of these.
Okay, let's get back inside Putin's head if we can. No, that's good. It's really good context and we need to be exploring how our interests overlap with Russia's. I think that's very interesting. How would you, Will, describe Putin's political philosophy and its evolution? And I guess also he's very shaped by his Russian Orthodox connections and perhaps is religion a factor here too? Maybe not. There's shaking of heads here. Let's start with political philosophy. He is deeply read. He doesn't, I gather, access the internet. His minders do that. His security forces do that for him. He doesn't have a smartphone because he's paranoid, and you would be. But he has a deep interest in history.
Yeah, so his views have evolved, I think it's fair to say. I mean, he has from, I'd say in his early period, the one we're talking about, we could refer to him as a kind of liberal authoritarian. At home, very much about centralized authoritarian power, no dissent, and so forth. But on the capitalism front, all about, you know, as long as the oligarchs stay under his thumb and the Western companies stay under his thumb and follow the kind of the line of the Kremlin, he's okay with them making money. And in fact, what we begin to see is that the corruption of the 1990s doesn't go away. So he kind of allows this corruption. And one of the key parts of his statecraft is he kind of collects information as a good KGB agent would. And if someone's doing something you don't like, you just pass over a little sheet of paper with all of these things. I just got to give this to the prosecutor. But, you know, for my friends, everything, for my enemies, the law, right? That's really the way he governs from that way forward. Now, what does it come to his political, I mean, you know, Liz is right. Transactionalism is one way to describe, and this is why I think he and Trump see each other so, and you know, see eye to eye on a lot of things. He doesn't have a lot of, I think, core beliefs. I mean, he talks about how he was christened as a child. Now, whether that's true or not is unclear. It's very unclear. He's not a particularly religious man. He talks a lot about religion. He wears a kind of cross, but I don't think he's actually particularly religious. He's, of course, a divorced man who likely has a number of illegitimate children. You know, these
so, and two on the public stage as well.
Yes, that's right.
Daughters.
That's right. So he's not particularly your strongest example of a kind of religiously driven ideology, but he has in recent years, particularly during COVID, gotten very into Russian imperial history, and he would very much like to see himself, I think, as Peter the Great, Vladimir the Great, who is restoring Russia. And, you know, there's this Russian word smuta, which means time of troubles, where you know Russia has this historical pattern where it goes into collapse and then reasserts itself. He would very much like to see himself.
So is this about expansionism, empire? Is this where we see the end point for Ukraine?
This is the imperial mindset. And exactly. For him, as he's reading these things during COVID, something changes in his mind. He suddenly sees Ukrainians as not a real nation. And the extent to which Ukrainians have a national identity, he views it as being created by the West, as fabricated. And that's the imperial mindset that we see now. And in some ways, that has changed him. I mean, if we talk about his evolution, he's suddenly gotten a whole lot less flexible on a lot of policies than he would have been before, because you know, he was, you know, in the early 2000s to by the 2020s. And the last thing I'll say is his evolution is shaped by the pandemic. During the pandemic, he was so isolated. He was terrified of getting the COVID-19 virus. Anyone who saw him had to quarantine for 20 days and walk through what was called a disinfection tunnel.
His twins as well, his children,
yeah.
His Elizabeth. Children were also sent away.
Twin children were sent away.
Yeah, just picking up on a couple of points that Will's really, really greatly framed. Strategic transactionalism, I think, is the best way to kind of understand this man. But in two areas that you raise, the first one in terms of what happened to, I guess, the new age oligarchs. So there are plenty of private resource firms in Russia. There are various rules, so international firms can have no majority in owning any of the projects, any of the future licenses. So it's very controlled. This is Putin's, you know, he's all over energy. That's his baby, because I think he just understands that's the future, right? So understanding the survival of the state. Now, for so long, when I was watching Russia and trying to figure this place out, I thought it was survival of him, survival of his leadership, right, is key. But increasingly, I do think it's kind of switched to the idea it's just survival of Russia. This is a project, his legacy, that needs to have something to show for when he's gone. On the oligarch point, what's fascinating is the strategic use of these firms. So they're always allowed at the table if you're going to serve the Russian national interest. So look at Antarctica. The Russian bases that are being built there, that are being developed, they're actually being paid for and built by Novatek, which is a huge Russian gas company. So there's always that overlap. And the second thing about the religion point, I absolutely agree with Will. I think it's useful for a vast majority of the older Russian community to be very much about the Orthodox life in voting terms. But it is used as a tool internationally to also keep compatriots and Russians that are Australian citizens in line.
But also another alignment with Trump is his he has lent right into ultra-nationalist literature, I gather,
ultra-conservative,
ultra-right literature.
Yeah.
I was looking at one of his epic six-hour speeches that he gives to the 2 hours, I might be exaggerating, but the annual Valde Club. And the one that he gave in 2021 was very aligned with Trump in terms of the culture wars, the role of family, you know, this the disintegration of the
but
of Western society.
But this is tapping into fear, right? People in what's left of the West don't like quote-unquote woke agendas.
He was talking
so
about
that's
wokeism.
What he was bringing out.
Yeah. I mean, why do you think he's doing that?
Continuity of a plan, of a stable Mother Russia, something to show for when he is gone, because he will die. And that's what we need to be thinking about. What comes after Putin?
We do indeed. Will, you wanted to pick up.
Well, I would say that, I mean, another thing that Trump and Putin share, they're very good communicators. So they use these types of messaging as ways of building their legitimacy, right? And they, and particularly, you know, because it's very difficult for both Trump and Putin to talk about family values given both of their background, their lives, right? It's fair to say. So there's that. But the other thing that I think we do need to talk about is that there's a tension here. We've talked about how Putin comes from this traumatized background. He's traumatized as a child in post-World War II Leningrad. He's traumatized when the Soviet Union collapses. He's terrified of anarchy. He's terrified that, you know, things are going to collapse. So what is his answer? Centralization of authority in the office of one individual, the office of the Russian president. That's
vertical
the constitutional
power
system. And as Liz is saying, what's your plan when you know, I mean, he would like to live, I think, for a long time. There was a hot mic between him and Xi Jinping where they talked about transhumanism, where they were talking about, oh, maybe humans can live for 150 years longer than normal. Right? These guys are really thinking about this.
They're taking all the anti-aging drugs.
Oh, he goes into he has got an actual freezing chamber where he goes to try to keep himself to extend his life. I mean, he doesn't drink. He's obsessed with health. He, you know, all these different things. So, there's a real, and, you know, so I think what we're seeing here is a creation of this state that actually, you know, he wants to preserve the Russian state by centralizing authority, but he's actually making it more brittle and more corrupt. And this is where someone like Alexei Navalny is really interesting. You know, the Navalny movement comes up in the late 2000s and 2010, 2011, and there's a discussion of, you know, what is the future now? Like, Putin has reestablished kind of stability, but what's next? Mm. And this, we have this individual who's been in power now for 26 years and more and counting, who has got this extremely defensive crouch position to how the Russian state should be set up, which is everything's determined in this office of the president. But of course, he's made himself indispensable to some extent. What happens when he goes, which will happen at some stage, it will be a huge, huge question.
Well, let's consider what's happening inside Russia for a moment. Russians that I've spoken to who have left the country left around the time of the Ukraine war. It became untenable for them to function in Russia, and it was terrifying for them. How would you describe the relationship he has to Russian citizens in all their diversity? So is there a surviving opposition, an underground opposition? And what about his supporters?
Well, to your first question, what's his relationship with the average Russian now? You pointed out before, he doesn't use the internet. He doesn't use a cell phone. Russia is one of the most digitized societies in the world. You get on the metro in Russia, and Liz will see this, everyone's on their phone. They're obsessed. And it is, and what we've seen in recent months is that the FSB has managed to lobby Putin to say, look, let's just turn off the internet at times. And they've been doing that. That is creating chaos, including in Moscow, the most sophisticated city in the Russian Federation, where everything is done online. You do your shopping online. You order your taxis online. Everything is done online. And Putin has been largely disconnected from this discussion. I don't think he fully understands the impact it's having on people. There have been little protests around this already, and it's creating a lot of dissension. So I think it is fair to say that he's getting, because of the system that he's created and the centralization within it, he's getting increasingly disconnected from the Russian people, and the people around him are not giving him a lot of, I think, the facts of what's happening.
But doesn't he command propaganda very well, Elizabeth Buchanan, internally as well? I mean, he presents himself as a man of the people. He speaks to the people at length. Do people see through that, or do they feel that there's a strong man
in
power?
I'm going to be really controversial here.
Go for it.
For a change. I think it depends, first of all, on what generation of Russian you're talking to. And also, there is a relationship with what is happening right now with the quote-unquote liberal West and how we are disintegrating.
A failed experiment.
I hope we can salvage aspects, but I do think...
Just putting his words out there.
Propaganda. before Trump 2.0, I would have said that the younger generation, the 20s and 30s-year-olds, were very suspect of the Russia that they're in, the riots, what's happening versus the rest of the world and how things seem a little bit different. And Putin's base of support was the older, you know, the boomer and older, who had experienced the chaos, the vouchers for food, the introductions of jeans back into the economy. So they were much more, I think, willing to get behind whatever Putin needs to do to keep
stability, to get us back
kicking
on track.
And it was the younger generations that were kind of the problem.
But capitalism.
Right. But I think what has happened with Trump 2.0 and the trashing of the quote-unquote alternative to what Russian managed democracy is now I've got various friends in Moscow and St. Petersburg primarily who are of my generation, the millennial and the Gen Z, who go, we actually have rethought our views on Putin. He's done great things for the country and we'll just ride out whatever is coming. So there's been some kind of generational shift again.
Back to Putin.
Back to Putin. Will, I don't know if you see it different.
Yeah, I mean, there is a big discussion right now in the Russia watching community about this. I mean, it is very difficult to know what the views of Russian, particularly young Russians, are with respect to Putin and the system. You know, there's no question that at this stage people are not willing to say anything publicly because of the level of repression is incredibly high. Mm-hmm. So I'd be cautious about making broad generalizations about young Russians at this stage. I mean, it is fair to say I do think there was a lot of celebration in the Kremlin when Trump was reelected. And they saw the world coming in their direction, and they have pushed that propaganda line very effectively. Now, I do think what we're seeing, like a lot of the Russians I know who live in Moscow and still around the country, have largely just gone internally. I think they're unwilling to face a lot of what's happening. They're unwilling to face what Russia's doing in Ukraine. They're unwilling to kind of even really think about politics at all. They just think they've just cordoned that part of their brain completely off. And whether that's support for Putin or not, they're not willing to protest. But would they go out and support, if Putin were trying to be overthrown? I think they'd stay home then,
perhaps,
too. There's a lot of apathy, I think.
Perhaps if he can't avoid full-on stagnation, you might see some kind of progress.
And the economic situation...
It's bad.
And what about the role... What about the impact of sanctions, global sanctions, although that's somewhat changing now because of the oil crisis?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, what we've given as the Australian state to the Ukrainian cause is peanuts compared to what we as road users have given in terms of filling up our cars. The younger generations, I would say, are savvy. Will pointed out how technologically linked everything is. They have VPNs. I know friends were just using crypto. Everyone's moved to crypto. It's massive in Russia. You can still get your Nike shoes, drop ship them. And geography. So many 20-25 minute flights if you needed to, or you could ride a bicycle into Norway to pick up your packages. So there's a workaround.
But you can't protest on the streets, you can't work for a foreign-funded NGO, you can't be a free-thinking, independent journalist, you can do none of those things. So they're operating within a particular type of constraint.
Yeah, can I say something about sanctions? I mean, sanctions, for at least a couple of years, sanctions, there was a lot of very, very sophisticated sanctions-busting regimes that were set up by some very, very good technocrats in the Russian government. One of them who is Elvira Nabiullina, who is one of probably the most sophisticated central bankers in the world. It is no question that the Chinese are studying this, how the Russians have managed to avoid it. Now, those sanctions are starting to catch up from a lot of outside reporting, suggesting internal reporting, suggesting that the economic situation is getting worse. And what's particularly bad is, as Liz is saying, it is a very tech digitized society, particularly under the age of 40. Everyone's on Instagram, everyone's on Facebook, everyone's kind of all over these social platforms, Telegram. Now, what they're trying to do now is shut down VPNs. That's significant because everyone just moved to VPNs. Okay, fine. Now they're starting to attack VPNs. They're starting to say, look, you can no longer be on Insta. You can't get on Instagram anymore. That's really significant because a lot of people were, monetize these types of things in Russia. So this is, I think, now a
shift point potentially.
Potentially dangerous moment.
And what could it mean for any future uprisings against Putin by Russian citizens? Associate Professor Will Partlett is author of Why the Russian Constitution Matters. Dr. Elizabeth Buchanan is author of Red Arctic, Russian Strategy Under Putin. And they're joining me, Natasha Mitchell, as you are at the Sorrento Writers' Festival to consider what makes the Russian president tick. You're with ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. Coming up, is anyone waiting in the political wings to unseat Putin?
In terms of opposition, how do people see the death of Navalny in prison, for example, the opposition leader? And also his critics externally who have been poisoned, irradiated, any number of things. There's been some travesties on the world stage. And, there's a lot of conjecture about who and what's driving that, and is it Putin?
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think, for many people, a cost, and it's something they stomach because they get stability. I don't want to put a moral lens on this or whether who's right and who's wrong, but I think it is just they are a hardied group of people who have a generational ability to share the lessons and also the wounds from their past in a way that we don't do at all. 27 million lives lost in World War II? From the Soviet Union side. That is something that, I've got friends that have, I've got a 9-year-old, their kids are 8 and 7, and it is something that they still talk about. It is remembered, and we barely conjure up something for Anzac Day these days.
How does he see then Russia's... let's look at the state that Russia will be left in after Putin goes, I guess. So he's not a fan of the Communist Party legacy, the Soviet era legacy. He's pro free market. What comes next? And how does he exit?
These are kind of very million-dollar questions to answer, but I mean...
But you spend a lot of time thinking about, because you look at all the constitutional structures that he's put in place and others have put in place to ensure his continuity of power.
Yeah, so he uses the Constitution to maintain and centralize authority in the office of the president. So it will be very clear that when he goes, however that is, there will be a massive fight to take over that office, because that office will control Russian politics going forward. And I presume there's already, you know, a fair amount of under the, you know, like what Winston Churchill said, watching Russian politics is like watching bulldogs fighting under a carpet. There's going to be a lot of...
What a metaphor.
...informal Shark Tank-style politics about how do we capture that office. Now, that's an elected office, so you're going to need a communications team. You're going to need a ground game. You're going to need to have all this. And you presume that all these shifting elite groups, there are different ones. You've got the Siloviki, which is the security services, who are really kind of KGB guys and kind of dead-eyed kind of guys. And then you've got the technocrats. And then you've got the business guys, the oligarchs.
Is he arrested? Is he knocked off? I mean, it's all about survival for this man. That's why his current...
He'll eventually
current
die.
Wife,
He'll eventually die.
Current but wife to what and extent children does, are in Switzerland.
Sorry, Elizabeth, go on.
Like, there's clearly a backup plan here. He's saying his current wife and children are in Switzerland. Yeah. They're not there. But also, I think just taking a really boring IR lens to this question of what comes next. It's, I want to reverse it and say, well, what worked in terms of the liberal West and where we are in terms of our political leanings as part of that? Did sanctions do anything? I mean, it's a tool of deterrence. We were trying, we collectively, to change Russian behaviour when it came to what it was doing in Eastern Europe. It didn't change its behaviour. And isn't that a reflection more on what's in our toolkit?
Well, people have said Putin is often underestimated to the lengths to which he will go. He's a KGB man, he's a judo man, you know, he's a stayer. To what extent do you think what happens in Ukraine determines Putin's future?
It's going to play a huge role. I mean, the way that conflict ends, I think, will significantly shape what happens to him. I mean, I do think we do need to be planning for a post-Putin Russia, right? Like, thinking about that, because he will leave in some way, whether it's what's called a controlled transition or an uncontrolled transition. And a lot will depend on, the state of the war. Now, if the war is still going, I mean, one of the significant things about the Ukraine war is Russia has lost 10 times as many people, if not more, than they lost in Afghanistan over the course of 6 to 7 years. And this war has been going for 4 years. They have lost... probably on matter of casualties, close to 1 million, over 100,000 killed. This is not a war that's going to be easy to finish for anyone, and it's going to be a war that if Putin leaves office, however he does, his successor will have to deal with this war. And if the war is not ended, it will shape post-Putin politics in a really significant way and what's going on underneath that carpet.
In what way?
Well, I mean, whoever is coming into power will have to provide, what's the plan? Is the plan to pull out of Ukraine? Is it to hold on to the territory that they have? Is it to continue to prosecute the war? What's the position of the Kremlin on this? Now, the technocrats who, you know, might try to make a deal with the West and say, okay, well, look, we'll stop bombing Ukrainian cities, but we'll keep what we have. And maybe the West will accept that. Who knows? But there's going to be a lot of jockeying around how does this conflict end if it's still going when Putin leaves office. Now, if it's finished, then we're in a different world.
I don't think we're looking at a resolution because I think they are two very different ends here. It's impossible. And even if it was a complete failure and the West came together, because keep in mind, we have not tried... And this is a point that I've debated with the Ukrainian ambassador to Australia, Vasil, a number of times, and he would agree. We've not tried to help Ukraine win. We've just tried to help Ukraine survive. We could have helped them win. That is a choice for the whole other set of, you know, shitty political reasons there. But even if he did lose, it would be framed, number one, in the Russian media as a win. We know that. So what's the point in trying to debate how it does end? But I think it ends with a stalemate, and whoever Washington picks to be the Ukrainian leader popped.
Right. So your point, you can tilt your head towards America, or you can tilt your head towards a Europe, which is, you know, has been consolidating around the threat to NATO, building up their own military capacity
but
in a different way.
Dragging their feet on allowing Ukraine into NATO or fast-tracking EU. They're all choices that are made, right? In terms of Putin, what comes at the end of his leadership, or what comes in how the country will remember this man when he's gone, who knows? I do wonder if he might end up as was the Security Council, some kind of like king head or figurehead that kind of still lurks around the Kremlin halls.
Here's a possibly weird question for you, but who will be at his deathbed?
Well, I mean, I don't know if any of
He's got an old judo friend from childhood that he's close to, an oligarch.
Has anyone seen Lenin in state, in Moscow, in Leh? Yeah. I got kicked out of that room. Funny story I can tell you about.
Oh, might need to ask that. But who will be at his deathbed? Who loves Putin? Who is intimate with Putin? Who is loyal and in love with Putin?
It's a terrible joke here, but you go
on.
Well, I mean, I will say, if you've seen The Death of Stalin, the film, I mean, you do wonder if there is, you know, if this is the kind of thing. I mean, he has given himself constitutionally the ability to be president, as Natasha said, till 2036, right? So that's a long time for a man who's now in his mid-70s. So, you know, there might be no plan, actually, at this stage to have a succession to actually for him to step down and do anything different, because he just has seen what's happened in other authoritarian regimes when powerful presidents step down. Kazakhstan's a really interesting example. I won't get into that. But, you know, if a president stepped down there and essentially was pushed out of power and significantly discredited. So I think he doesn't trust anything, doesn't trust anyone. So it might be a situation like that. Who would be there and supporting him? I mean, he has some old friends from St. Petersburg, his old judo buddies, some of whom are now major oligarchs who would probably mourn his death. But I think the real focus will be is who is going to be in that position going forward. There will be the fight to fill that office of the president so that who will set the direction for Russia going forward from there.
And are there any candidates creeping up behind him?
No, because as soon as you're a candidate, you're going to find yourself thrown out of a window.
Right, you're gone.
You're going to be flying out the window. But, you know... I do think that...
But is there a sense that he has a protege?
No, not at all. Because, of course, that would make him a lame duck. And, you know, we can see a slightly similar situation probably going to unfold in the United States where Donald Trump is not going to want to...
But he'd also be signaling that he plans to leave. And that would cause panic for some Russians.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one of the ways in which the Russian Putin system works is he is the guarantor. He's the holder of the keys, all the information, sensitive financial information, because all of these guys are corrupt, right? And that is the big concern. Everyone around, there's a huge, what people call the collective Putin, all of these oligarchs and business people and KGB guys, all of whom are terrified that if someone like a Navalny came in, they're going to end up in jail, right? Or worse, something. So, you know, particularly, but they're going to get prosecuted. So so however they decide, it will be someone who's going to have to play this role again if they want to maintain this system, which, to be honest, isn't really serving the Russian people well at all, but that has got its own kind of self-perpetuating, self-interested kind of logic.
Can you imagine a time where there will be free, fair elections, Elizabeth?
In Russia? No.
I'd like to say I'm an optimist. I think it's possible. It would require another situation like we had in the Soviet Union where the system implodes.
Yes.
The whole thing implodes and everyone...
Nuclear power. Yeah. Nuclear power implodes.
No, but I mean, a controlled implosion, you don't want
anarchy. Would the security forces let him do that?
If the security forces were guaranteed safety, maybe. Now, it would have to be. I mean, the collapse of the Soviet Union and how it happened in a peaceful way is one of the truly remarkable stories of the last 100 years.
Yep.
And the fact that there was not significant breakdown of, you know, because obviously they managed to get nuclear weapons out of the successor states, including Ukraine. They did a lot around, and there was some violence, particularly in Central Asia, but largely not violence in the Eastern European parts of the Soviet Union. So, yeah, it is a very dangerous time for the world when or if the state were to implode. But there is a possibility, and there is an opposition waiting in Europe now who could do this, and it's the Navalny movement and Navalny's widow and the people around her who are very sophisticated. They're surrounded by very sophisticated people who could potentially play some role in that, maybe working with a technocrat. So it's not out of the realm of possibility, but is it likely? Probably.
It's a sense of, you know, pick your chaos.
Pick your chaos.
Pick your chaos.
Can I just quickly ask and squeeze this one in very briefly, 10 seconds, how will he continue playing the nuclear card? Elizabeth?
Putin? I mean, it's a foundational part of why he believes in his vision of Russia on the world stage, that they have a legitimate place in a security sense. It's the nuclear weapon card. So it's that kind of terrible use of the word Trump card.
Yeah.
It's not going to go away.
I mean, I'll just say very briefly, it is the only card Russia still has with a declining economy, declining demographics, and a country that is not doing particularly well, kind of digitally either in terms of its innovation. Its nuclear hard power is its real Trump
card. But only having that as your sole source of strategic power, that's not a good thing in this day and age.
And just finally, the funny story.
Oh, I'm going to throw my mum under the bus. She's not here. Mum and I decided to see the man. Love mum.
This is
rummaging.
This is Lenin.
Lenin in the tomb there in Red Square. My mum decided to rummage through her handbag. Stuff, if anyone knows a nana here, stuff went everywhere. You've been there, so it's very tightly guarded.
Oh, no.
We were escorted out.
Lipsticks flying.
Literally.
Literally. I feel like we've had a real privileged hour here with two experts in their field. What a privilege to share a conversation with you both. Thank you for your scholarship. Thank you for doing it from Australia as well. It's really important that we
fund Russian studies.
It's very important that we cultivate scholarship in Australia and that our universities thrive so that we have experts like this developing their skills and expertise on the wider world, and that we also showcase an Australian lens on the wider world. You know, the more myopic we become, I think the more dangerous it is for all of us everywhere. Enjoy the rest of your festival. Please thank Will Partlett and Elizabeth Buchanan.
The machinations of Putin's peculiar, particular world of power and what will be the outcomes of his meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping this week, as it happens in the audience of this session at the Sorrento Writers' Festival, was longtime former ABC Russia correspondent Monica Attard. Had I known, I might have pulled her up on stage with my guests, Associate Professor Will Partlett from Melbourne Law School and the Centre for Public Integrity. He's author of Why the Russian Constitution Matters, co-author of The People's Guide to the Australian Constitution. Dr. Elizabeth Buchanan from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute and co-director of the Polar Warfare Studies at West Point Military Academy's Modern War Institute is author of Red Arctic, Russian Strategy Under Putin, and So You Want to Own Greenland. And if you're at the Sydney Writers' Festival or the Make Good Festival in Bundanon across in New South Wales, I'll see you at one or both. Look for B in our audience on the Big Ideas homepage to find out more. And you can email us, bigideas@abc.net.au. Next week, journalist Lisa Wilkinson joins me. Now, you've heard of the story of the Titanic disaster, but have you heard of the story of Evelyn, its only Australian survivor? She was a young nurse from rural South Australia, set on seeing the world at a time when women's lives were very constrained. But she was a powerful rower, adept at Morse code. It's almost like the Titanic disaster, tragically, was waiting for someone like her to show up.
Well, she only ever gave two interviews, and that's the reason why this story never got any bigger than really sitting in the dark cobweb corners of the internet. One of the things I discovered is that, like so much of history, our history is told by men. And everything that I was seeing on the Titanic was stories being told by men. So I knew that there was an opportunity there when I discovered that there were so many incredible women on the Titanic. There were 434 of them. And they were everything from political activists to the highest paid, most famous movie star in the world at the time, the most celebrated fashion designer in Paris at the time, a big game hunter, don't condone, but wow, big game hunter, female, at the turn of the century is extraordinary.
On the Titanic.
Yeah. Suffragettes, these incredible women. And I couldn't understand why their collective story had never been told, but I also knew that they were going to help me tell Evelyn's story.
And it's incredible what Lisa Wilkinson unearthed. She joins me on Big Ideas next week with a live audience from the Victorian goldfields town of Castlemaine. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.